This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Like a spreading weed, Alzheimer's disease attacks sufferers by clogging the brain's once spindly and delicate neurons with an overgrowth of protein. Those signature plaques and tangles damage the brain's communication structures and block its information highways. Patients lose their memory, their ability to think and care for themselves. Eventually, they die. But my next guest says that an over-the-counter supplement, a vitamin, can cut through that snarled protein mess, at least in laboratory animals. His studies show that large doses of vitamin B3 can protect mice with Alzheimer's from memory loss and mental decline by blocking one kind of neuron damage that caused by the protein tangles. The treatment works so well, in fact, that the Alzheimer's mice can act and perform just like mice that don't have the disease at all. His study is published in the journal Neuroscience. Joining me now to talk about it and how maybe possible some new human trials in the works is my guest, Kim Green, a research scientist at the University of California, Irvine. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Green.
Thank you. Hello. It's great to be speaking with you.
You're welcome. Now, you found that the vitamin prevents the symptoms of Alzheimer's in mice. How did you come about to test this product?
Well, we were interested in nicotinamide, not because it was a vitamin, but because of its pharmacological abilities to inhibit a group of enzymes known as sirtuins. And these sirtuins are implicated in longevity or living longer successfully. And of course, with Alzheimer's disease being a disease of aging, we wanted to see what happens to the disease progression when we're able to modulate these pathways associated with aging. And so that's why we selected this compound in the first place.
Mm-hmm. So you found some mice, you genetically engineered mice to have a mouse version of Alzheimer's.
Exactly. We have some transgenic mice, and these are normal mice that we have taken the human genes that give rise to the proteins, mm-hmm. which aggregate in the Alzheimer's disease brain, and we've injected those into the mouse eggs, mm-hmm. to create a new mouse, and as this mouse ages, it produces these proteins, and they form the same sort of pathology that you find in the human brain. They develop these extracellular amyloid beta plaques, and also these intraneuronal aggregates composed of tau protein, which are known as these tangles. And what we find for these mice is as they age and as they develop these two pathologies, they get cognitive impairment at the same time.
And you then gave the mice this vitamin B3 right in their water?
Exactly. This stuff is very easy to give, which makes our lives a lot easier. And we very simply just put it in their drinking water for 4 months as they aged. And at the end of that 4 months, we tested their memory. So we wanted to see what effect it had on their cognitive abilities.
And you were surprised by the results?
I was very surprised. It has been far more successful and encouraging than I could have imagined. And when we looked at the mice, we found that they performed at the same level as a mouse that is not programmed to develop Alzheimer's disease. Hmm. So it completely prevented the cognitive deficits associated with the pathology.
And you actually gave it to normal mice, and it improved their behavior too?
Exactly. That was also quite surprising. So it also suggests that this stuff could be good for healthy people as well, and it can improve memory function. So it looks like it can be cognitive enhancing of its own right. But especially beneficial in the neurodegenerative disease such as Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, when people hear about this study, they're going to be flooding the health food stores.
Yeah.
Is there a danger to vitamin B3?
Yes, there certainly is. If you take it in high doses, there can be liver toxicity associated with this. And the sort of doses we're using, because we're using it as a pharmacological agent rather than the vitamin, you're getting towards those sort of doses. And so I would certainly not recommend that people go out and start taking high doses of this stuff until we've looked at it more carefully in humans to work out what a safe and effective dose could be.
Are there studies planned for humans?
Absolutely. We're recruiting for clinical trials at the moment here at UC Irvine, and we want to get started on those as quickly as possible so we can find out if it's as effective in humans as it's shown to be promising in mice.
Mm-hmm. You've also done work with omega-3s.
Yes. We're particularly interested in looking at safe, effective therapies that people can take that can affect their likelihood to develop Alzheimer's disease. And it turns out that people can actually do a lot for themselves. Like heart disease, you can change your lifestyle to prevent neurodegenerative diseases, in particular Alzheimer's disease. And dietary factors and environmental factors can play large roles. And one of the big dietary factors is the daily intake of omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids, such as DHA, docosahexaenoic acid. And that works by reducing the amyloid beta peptide in the brain.
Mm-hmm. Can other vitamins possibly have an effect on Alzheimer's?
Other what, sorry?
Other vitamins.
Other vitamins. Well, so there have been a lot of trials with vitamins over the years, and they have shown a lot of promise, and people have done a lot of research. But unfortunately, at the moment, a lot of it has shown that it doesn't have an effect in the clinic. And other vitamins such as B6 and B12 and E haven't been successful in clinical trials. And that by no means means that vitamin B3 is not going to be successful, because they work in completely different ways.
How does B3 actually work on those tangles? It doesn't appear from your research that it works on all of the problems in the brain, the plaques, but it does work on the tangles.
It does. It seems to be very specific in what it does, and it's able to stimulate the neurons to degrade tau once it's become phosphorylated at a specific residue. And the normal function of this tau protein in neurons is to help transport things from the cell body all the way to the extremities. Neurons are very long cells. They need an effective transport system to survive and send energy and proteins from one end to the other. And the tau sort of strengthens this highway. And when it becomes phosphorylated, it falls off this highway, and the highway begins to break down, so you can't transport stuff effectively anymore. And what the nicotinamide does is it's able to get rid of this phosphorylated tau once it's produced, so the highway remains strengthened, and so that transport can continue to occur.
That's quite interesting. Are you looking for volunteers for your human studies?
Oh, we are, absolutely. They have to be in the local area, Orange County. They need to get to where we are in Irvine. And we need around 50 to 70 patients for a six-month clinical trial with nicotinamide.
Well, we have a huge audience in your neighborhood.
I hope so. I really do. That
huge,
would be great.
Huge audience in your neighborhood. And we then go to Science Friday and learn how to reach you there also. Are there foods that naturally contain vitamin B3?
Well, there are other foods, meat, fish, beans, cereals, and potatoes. But quite honestly, the sort of levels that you can find these foods probably aren't sufficient to have a big effect.
And once again, you warn that taking too much B3 can be toxic.
Absolutely. This is why we're doing the clinical trials, to work out a safe and effective dose. I mean, if we have patients here on known doses, we can monitor liver function and make sure that they're looking healthy. Now, having said that, there was a study that came out a couple of years ago that followed a group of elderly people for several years. And they looked at those patients that developed Alzheimer's disease versus those that didn't, and then looked at all their different dietary intakes. And they found an inverse risk associated with developing Alzheimer's disease with niacin, which is another form of vitamin B3. And these are people taking it in a sort of health food supplement form. And so there is some, you know, fairly promising evidence out there that even low doses that you'd find in your health store at the moment could be protective.
How close is the animal model to a real human model of Alzheimer's?
This is about as close as we can get, but it's not perfect. It's a big leap from a mouse to a human. But what the problem with Alzheimer's disease is, it's a very complicated disease. It's very widespread. It affects many areas of the brain. We have multiple pathologies, this tau pathology, this amyloid pathology. We get inflammation, oxidative damage. And so it's very difficult for one therapy in particular to be able to cure all the different things that are going wrong. And what's great about something like nicotinamide and DHA and some of these other things is that we can combine them together to try and target multiple pathologies simultaneously. And that's probably what is going to be the most effective in the future, is putting multiple different approaches together.
What other effects did it have on the brain? Did it enhance the structure of the brain itself?
No, not so much. We were looking mainly at the protein level, at the biochemical level, and the effects appeared to centralize around these microtubule highways, and they upregulated a number of proteins that are associated with the stability of these highways.
And it's interesting that even in the normal mice, their memories were enhanced, correct?
Exactly. I mean, it just shows that this stuff has a beneficial effect in healthy mice as well as Alzheimer's disease. And it's probably through similar mechanisms. You know, if you strengthen your highways in normal neurons, they probably work more effectively than if you haven't.
The fact that this is something that's a generic form, that, you know, the drug companies are not going to invest in, I imagine, in research against, because it's freely available.
Well, it it's freely available. And, part of our research is to highlight things like this, which people can go out and take once we've discovered if it's effective. But what we do know is that it inhibits this class of enzymes known as sirtuins. So if it turns out perhaps that nicotinamide isn't as effective in humans, we could now use this family of enzymes as a new drug target to develop new small molecular inhibitors that do the same job but more effectively at lower doses. Mm-hmm. And that's something that drug companies could be interested in.
Is it necessary to do any more animal testing, or do you just go right on to human testing?
Well, we're going right on to human testing because it is something that's freely available. Of course, if this was an unknown compound, we'd have to do a lot more safety profiling before we could make that leap. And so in many ways, this makes our job a lot quicker by using things that are already out there in the population.
So you don't have to go to the phase one trial because it's been out there a while?
Exactly. So we can go straight to phase two.
And are you looking for Alzheimer's patients?
Absolutely. It has to be mild to moderate. The more mild, the better. The problem with Alzheimer's disease is once you have it, it's very hard to see how we're going to be able to reverse it. Mm-hmm. Because by the time a patient has cognitive decline, is presenting with symptoms, they already have a great deal of pathology in their brains. They already have a great deal of neuronal loss. And ideally, what we want to be able to do is to prevent people from developing the pathology and the neuronal loss in the first place.
Right.
But that's very hard to do in a clinical trial, because we can't identify the people who are going to develop Alzheimer's disease in order to prevent
right.
it. So we need to, try and pick the best approaches we have and try them in people who already have pathology and hope that we see an effect.
Well, good luck to you, doctor.
Okay, thank you.
And hopefully we'll be able to send some patients your way.
I hope so. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Kim Green is a research scientist at the University of California at Irvine. And if you want to get in on his study, contact him there or go to our webpage and we'll send you to a link in that direction. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about the human genome, sequencing the human genome, and how they have sequenced the first person with cancer and the differences that knowing what the genes were in that cancer person tells us about helping to diagnose it later on. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatto. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. Up next, cancer genetics. About 10 years ago, when the project to sequence the human genome was getting underway, cancer researchers in St. Louis got the idea that they could learn a lot about cancer by looking at the genes of a cancer patient. Now, most cancers are caused by something that goes wrong in the genes, so they started planning and waiting, because at that time it would have cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 million to do that genome sequence. But as the years went by, the technology got cheaper and the cancer researchers, backed by a philanthropist, got their wish. They were able to sequence the genome, well, actually two genomes, really, of a woman who died of leukemia. They sequenced the DNA from both her tumor and her skin so they could compare the healthy and the cancerous genes and see genetically what went wrong in the cancer cells. So what did they find out? Now that's what we're going to talk about with Dr. Timothy Lay. He is an MD and a professor in the Department of Medicine in the Oncology Division at Washington University in St. Louis. Thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure, Ira. Nice to be here.
You're welcome. My number is 1-800-989-8255 if you want to talk about the cancer oncology and genealogy of it. And if you're on a Twitter, we have a new feature we're doing now. We're Twittering. You can join a conversation by tweeting your ideas at SciFry, at SciFritter. SciFritter. Just write the at sign followed by SciFritter. That's SciFritter. So tell us about this, about the leukemia first, so we can understand what you found, doctor.
Well, this is a big project that involved many, many people. First, I have to say that this brought together two distinct groups of researchers at our university, the cancer doctors, the physician scientists who study leukemia and take care of our patients, led by John DiPerzio and I, and the Genome Center, who did all the sequencing and analysis in a close collaboration with Rick Wilson and Elaine Martis there. And then, of course, there's nothing without our patients who have the disease and who took the risk to get their genome sequenced. And I have to thank them for participating in these studies. So the disease itself is acute myeloid leukemia. And this is a bad disease. I think a lot of people know someone who's had the disease.
Mm-hmm.
It's a cancer of the blood. It occurs in cells that make blood, which normally reside in the bone marrow. And these cells acquire genetic mutations during the course of a person's life that lead to abnormal proliferation of the cells or signals that cause them to die at the wrong time, die too late, or to fail to differentiate. And what happens is these abnormal cells basically take over the normal marrow space. They crowd out all of the normal blood-making cells so that you develop severe anemia and need blood transfusions, so that you're more susceptible to infections because you don't have normal white cells. And also you have a tendency to bleed because you don't make the normal platelets in the marrow, which are important for clotting.
Mm-hmm.
So that combination is a lethal trio, and it's a very bad disease. And even though we do a pretty good job of treating it, and most of our patients die from this disease still.
And so you wanted to sequence the genome of a person who had that disease.
The problem is that we don't know what causes the disease for the vast majority of our patients. We don't know the genetic underpinnings yet. And we've been trying, and many investigators around the world for years and years, to understand the mutations that cause this disease. And with the advent of the modern genomics, we've thrown the book at patients with this disease, tried every new modern platform imaginable that looks at all of the genes' expression and whether they're present or absent. Everything's been tried, and we sequenced lots and lots of candidate genes that we thought we understood and we thought that might be involved with leukemia development. But none of these approaches, after years and years of preparation and work with patients who had participated with us, none of these approaches were really telling us what the genetic disease is comprised of. What are the real mutations that are causing the disease? And a couple years ago, when this new technology became available for very, very high throughput, rapid sequencing at low cost, called next-generation sequencing, we decided really the only chance we had to find these mutations was to just bite the bullet and sequence the whole genome. And we had prepared for this for years and years by getting skin samples and tumor samples from patients with leukemias who we saw here at WashU at the Siteman Cancer Center. And we banked them all away. And then we looked at hundreds of them to pick one patient who would be perfect for the first analysis, who would have just two copies of all of her genes and with a very common kind of the disease that we face very often, and in whom we know almost nothing about the mutations that cause the disease. So she was picked as our first patient.
And you found the difference between the cancer genes, the genome, and the cancerous tumor, and in her normal skin cells?
We did. We knew that we had to sequence her normal cells and her tumor because there's an enormous amount of genetic variation that exists between individuals.
Mm-hmm.
For the first few genomes that have been done, we know that there are millions of differences between each of us, and those are called SNPs, or single nucleotide polymorphisms in the genome. There are normal variations in the genome that probably, you know, help to make us the different people that we are. But we don't know how they contribute to diseases yet, and we don't know how they contribute to disease like this one. So we knew we would find millions of differences between her genome and other genomes that had been sequenced, but how would you ever know which ones were responsible? So we had to sequence her normal genome, and we had to sequence her tumor independently, and then compare the two to find the differences. What we found really, it astonished us, that we only found 10 differences between her tumor genome and her skin. And 8 of these were completely new. They were mutations that had been acquired in the tumor that were not present in her skin, that were in genes that we had never before suspected in this disease. 2 of the mutations that we found, we knew about before we went in. Those are in genes that are commonly mutated in patients with this disease. They don't cause the disease, but we think they contribute to its progression. We know they're involved with the disease, but they don't cause it per se. So these 8 new mutations were not on our radar. Now, in retrospect, they all make a lot of sense to us because they're involved with things. It's easy to imagine how they might be participating in the genesis of this cancer. We don't know exactly what they do or how they fit together yet, But just to find them for the first time and to know all of the mutations that might be contributing to one person's cancer is really a milestone for us in terms of thinking about how to really figure out the genetic roots of this disease.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Talking with Dr. Timothy Lay. So does that mean that you can use this as a screening technique or not in normal people? It doesn't sound like you could just screen people for these mutations, because if you take their skin cells, for example, you're not going to find them in normal tissue.
These are mutations that are acquired in the tumor. Our current understanding of cancer suggests that a cancer starts maybe with one mild perturbation, an acquired mutation, that gives a cell a little bit of an advantage. Mm-hmm. And that advantage persists over time until another random event occurs that gives the cell a little bit more of an advantage. And over time, these mutations accumulate in the cells that have more and more of an advantage, and these cells basically just start to take over. Now, our guess about this patient's tumor is that these 10 mutations basically were in almost all of her tumor cells, nine of them in every single one, and one, probably the last mutation that she acquired, was present in most of her cells, but not all. So our guess would be that each one of these mutations contributed a little something to the tumor,
right?
And that as they accumulated over the period of time that our tumor was growing, they all were important, and they all added a little bit of something that was relevant for her disease.
And the fact that you found 8 new ones was very significant then.
We would never have found these with any other method. That's one of the biggest lessons for us, is I think that we have to use these unbiased approaches to find these mutations. Ira, we just don't know enough about cancer yet to guess correctly about the genes that might be involved. You know, in retrospect, you know, you hit yourself in the forehead and said, yeah, of course, these genes make a lot of sense for a cancer, and I can see how they would be involved. But prospectively, we didn't have these on our radar. We hadn't thought about these genes as being specifically involved, and no one had sequenced them in patients with this disease because we just hadn't thought about them.
And I have a question from Second Life from Bauer, who says, I'm wondering why this was surprising. He expected fewer than 8 mutations or more. Did you expect more or less?
Nobody knew.
Yeah.
Nobody knew. I think the greatest fear in the cancer community was that we have this concept of cancer as being a genetically unstable disease. And that's because in lower resolution screens of some cancers, there are many variations in the copy numbers of genes. There are lots of chromosomes that seem to accumulate or lost in certain kinds of cancers. So I think our greatest fear was that there would be thousands or perhaps tens of thousands mutations that weren't relevant for the cause of the disease,
right,
but were just passengers and not really particularly involved in causation. So, you know, I think our greatest fear for many cancer biologists was that these tumors would have tens of thousands of mutations. And the old theories, of course, was that cancer was caused by a couple of mutations in different pathways. The two-hit hypothesis by Knudsen about 30 years ago, where two different mutations would contribute to the pathogenesis of the cancer.
Yeah.
So we never thought it would be that few. There were lots of studies that suggested it would be in the dozens, perhaps, or you know, 5 or 10 or 15. But our fear was that it would be 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000.
Well, knowing these few numbers, what do you do with this information now? Will this help you figure out what causes cancer to begin with?
Well, it will eventually.
Yeah.
This is the first step, sequencing a whole cancer genome. And the lesson is a good one. We can do it. With this new technology, the cost has been reduced to the point where it's no longer just fantasy to think about sequencing hundreds or thousands of cancer genomes over the next several years, which is really what needs to be done. What we don't know right now, Ira, what are the rules of cancer? What are the kinds of genes that need to be mutated to make a cancer? What combinations can occur to get you there?
Mm-hmm.
And what kinds of pathways are affected in cancers of different types? So this is just, you know, the first step in a marathon, I think. And I think that what we've learned is this technology will probably get us there. But it might be the only way to do it. The other lower resolution platforms for studying the genomes of cancer patients really have not told us what the answer is.
Well, where do you pick up a genetic possibility here, that some of the genes might have been passed on from, you know, in the family. Sure. We know that cancer has some sort of genetic component, right?
It does. And
is that lost here, or because would not see them in the skin, you would not see them, they would be the same, were they not in the skin as in the tumor?
That's a great question, and it's one of the biggest problems that we face, is that is the genetic variation that exists among individuals, is it relevant for cancer susceptibility? So how do you answer that question? Well, the way you have to do it is identify families that have cancer, and you have to sequence their genomes and compare them with the genomes of lots and lots of other people who don't have cancer. And in that way, by comparing basically whole genomes against each other in what we call now genome-wide association studies, which are snapshots of genomes but not the whole genome, we can begin to understand how individual variations in people's inheritance affect their susceptibility to cancer. The beauty of sequencing her normal cells and her tumor cells is, of course, we have all that information. We know what the patients inherit, and we know what's acquired. And someday, when thousands and thousands of these genomes have been sequenced, I think we'll have a very clear understanding of which inherited mutations are susceptibility mutations, which could be screened for in individuals, and which are the ones that were acquired, and whether there's any relationship between the two.
Talking with Dr. Timothy Lee on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Sorry, it's Dr. Lee, isn't it? It's, I always get everybody's name wrong, so you should feel right at home, doctor. would it be possible to intervene someplace along the line saying, hey, we know about your genome and we know you're susceptible before the cancer strikes?
Yeah, that's a hope. It's already being done for many people with familial cancer syndromes and people with some kinds of breast cancer that where it runs in families. Screening is initiated much earlier. The same is true for patients with some kinds of inherited mutations that can affect colon cancer development, for example. And screening techniques can be applied. For diseases like acute leukemia, the one we're studying here in this paper, the benefits also can be sooner rather than later. For years, we've actually looked at the genomes of patients with acute leukemia by looking at their chromosomes. And we've known for a long time, the work of many, many people around the world, that some people have a good prognosis because their chromosomes are a certain way, and some are going to do very poorly. Mm-hmm. And we actually use that information to customize the therapy of the individual right after they're diagnosed. People who are going to do very badly, we may make a decision to do a bone marrow transplant as part of their initial therapy, because if we don't, we know that they'll die of the disease very quickly. As we get these genetic rules of cancer from sequencing genomes, I know that we will find the mutations that portend a poor prognosis. And that will impact what we do immediately. We won't need designer drugs. We will be able to use the information to immediately impact on the care of patients, which is what this work is all about, because we'll know who is going to do well and who's going to do poorly, and we'll be able to customize the treatment of patients up front. That's one of the goals and one of the reasons why this disease was chosen to study, because we knew we wouldn't have to have new drugs in order to do really personalized medicine
right.
with the kinds of information.
Would you choose other cancers now or other diseases?
Well, I think that they all have to be done. There's an international consortium looking at other kinds of cancer to sequence, and 50 tumor types have been preliminarily selected for study. And I think the hope is that we can do hundreds of each of these 50 common tumor types over the next decade or so to really get at this issue that you mentioned. What are the rules of cancer? Are there susceptibility mutations that people inherit, and how do they interact with the acquired mutations in the tumors?
Mm-hmm. Would studying identical twins work at all here?
Identical twins, one of whom gets cancer, one does not?
Yeah.
It's something that people have thought about and done in certain kinds of hereditary cancer syndromes, and it can be very, very interesting and informative in certain pairs. Sometimes people don't get cancer at exactly the same time if they're identical twins, and that tells you that many cancers have different kinds of progression pathways.
One could be a smoker. One could be, working in a factory is a place where they're carcinogens.
There are environmental factors that could affect the mutations that contribute to the cancer as it develops, and there are just random things that can happen. And comparing those kinds of genomes between twins that get cancer at different times or different kinds of cancer could be extremely informative.
Dr. Lay, we've run out of time.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Very informative, and good luck to you.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Aaron.
You're welcome. Dr. Timothy Lay is an MD and professor in the Department of Medicine in the Oncology Division at Washington University in St. Louis. We're going to take a break and come back and talk more about some really interesting new stuff in diabetes, treating diabetes without using insulin, some other research published this week. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.